to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. And for those that are listening for the first time, this is a podcast that shines a light on those bands that perhaps haven't had the profile that we feel they've deserved from back in the 80s. I'm joined today by my good friend, Noel. Welcome, Noel.
Hi, hi.
Now, Noel, who have you brought to the table today?
Well, Martin, as you know, we are called Uncharted 80s, and Uncharted has two meanings, actually. So one of those meanings is you didn't get a record that was particularly high in the record charts, right? Now, this band definitely doesn't fall into that category. They had one massive hit.
Okay.
However, I think a lot of people would have them down as a one-hit wonder. And there is so many other great stuff that they've done. Like, you and I love this band. You know, I want to bring to the table and we can put a spotlight on those other great tunes. Now, if I tell you that massive hit that was massive across loads of countries was called Turning Japanese, you'd know it's The Vapors. So very excited to have them. The Vapors, and we've actually got Dave Fenton and Steve Smith speaking to us later. Very excited. So they were a new wave band from Guildford in Surrey. They initially formed in 78 and they made a massive splash in 1980, obviously, with Turning Japanese.
And who were they?
So the original members are a singer and guitarist, Dave Fenton, lead guitarist, Ed Begazet, bass is Steve Smith, and drums is Howard Smith, no relation to Steve. So that was the original members. They were around from 78 till 81. They did reform later, but we'll talk about that later on.
Tell us a bit about the early days then, the sort of 78, 79.
So Dave was a law student, and he obviously had a bit of talent for singing and songwriting, and he wanted to get a band together. So in 78, he put together the early version of The Vapors. So from 79 onwards, he had that settled band lineup that I've just mentioned. And they were playing a gig, actually, in a pub in Guildford. Now, also in Surrey, another big town is Woking. Now, from Woking, of course, are The Jam.
Yeah.
Massive band.
Love
massive.
It.
I mean, obviously, yeah. So Bruce Foxton, the bass player from The Jam, was actually at that pub watching the gig. And at that point, remember, The Jam were like, there was a massive, like, growing fan base, bigger and bigger buzz. So Bruce approached them actually and said, "Guys, can I manage you?" And they said, "Well, I didn't say no." he managed the Vapors along with Paul Weller's dad and the manager of The Jam, John Weller, who was a proper character anyway. I haven't seen him a few times with The Jam. And they got some, you know, really strong management there with some great connections. That was a great start.
I mean, that must have catapulted them, I would have thought, just by having that association.
Absolutely. You'd think so, wouldn't you? In May, they supported The Jam a couple of times on the tour that they were playing at the time. And then in July, they did a Peel session, John Peel. And they did, one of the songs they did was a really cracking tune called Trains.
Night or day, my body's aching in the cold and rain. I can't go home, can't
song.
Yeah, great song. Now, at that time, the BBC credited them as the Vapors. And the Vapors are the Vapors, as we just said, but the Vapors with a U.
Oh, right.
Which is
okay.
The kind of British spelling of Vapors, under like the band name we now know and love. In September, they signed to United Artists. So they've got their record label. And then in October, released their first single, Prisoners. Get into the charts, and it didn't appear on the first album, but it's actually a fantastic song.
Yeah, it is a great song.
Yeah, so then they supported the Jam on their Setting Suns tour, and they played 28 dates supporting the Jam.
Well, interesting enough, I went to see From the Jam, which is obviously the Bruce Foxton sort of version, on their Setting Suns when they redid that album, and the Vapors were supporting again.
Exactly that. But back in the day, when they did the original Setting Suns tour with the Jam, now, I don't know if I told you this, you know, I'm sort of a massive Jam fan. I actually saw the Jam exactly 20 times live. Yeah, and on that tour, I saw them 4 times live.
So the Vapors supporting the Jam 4 times?
Yes, yes.
Oh, God, right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Just as an aside, I was thinking the other day about it because one time I went down to the Rainbow in London. I saw them 2 consecutive nights with a mate from school, Ian Studley. And after the first night, we went and stayed with someone his family knew, and we had accommodation for the night. The next morning, we got up and we thought, well, we've got to get a train now. We don't want to carry bags around into a gig. So we went to Euston and paid for left luggage to leave our bags there. We went to the gig for the second night, finished the gig, again, fantastic, 2 nights at the Rainbow. We went back to Euston to get our bags and get on the train back to Northampton. Left luggage was closed, and we were like, what? Never expected it. And we couldn't get our bags back until the morning. And we didn't have loads of cash. We were just kids at that time. And so basically, we ended up sleeping on these steps to an underground car park. And it was the worst night ever. A little memory of that. those Rainbow gigs with the Jam on the Setting Suns tour, yeah.
On the Setting Suns tour, had they released anything else other than Prisoners? Or was that still their sort of first
single? Prisoners was the only thing that had been released. It was not until the month after, in Jan 80, that they released Turning Japanese, which, of course... as we know, became a huge hit.
Yeah, massive.
And it reached number 3 in the UK, number 1 in Australia, it reached number 7 in Canada. Oh, if I could mention loads of countries where it was top 10. And it also got into the US top 40. If I said Turning Japanese, I go, oh, I know that song. Then I say, do you know anything else by the Vapors? They'd say, nah, not really. I read up actually that it appeared in quite a few different movies as well as on the soundtracks, including Charlie's Angels, which you might know.
Oh, okay, yeah. Know that, yeah.
And others as well. They performed Top of the Pops twice with Turning Japanese in Feb and March of 1980. And obviously that helped them with their number 3 single in the UK. And then come May, they released their first album, just still an absolute classic album, which we both love, I know, called Nuclear Days.
Yeah, it's still an album that I'll listen to on a regular basis.
Every song's fantastic.
Didn't one of the Jam's producers do that, or am I mistaken?
Yes, it was Vic Coppersmith Heaven. He'd produced Turning Japanese, and he also produced the whole of the album. It had some great tracks on it, including such really strong songs as Bunkers.
Drumming you down.
Then in June, they released the second single, News at 10. Now, I think that's a great song, but it only reached number 50 in the charts.
That really surprises me because yeah. that is a strong song. What happened then?
Well, I think what that was that, do you remember when we spoke to the Photos, they had a real issue with one of their tunes that they couldn't get on top of the Pops because there was a musicians union strike. Well, that strike went on from the 29th of May to the 7th of August, 1980. And that was exactly what was going on at the very point that News at 10 was released. So they couldn't get on because of that. Hence why it only peaked at number 50 in the charts.
That strike really did sort of stop the momentum of so many bands, didn't it?
Absolutely. So many singles. Yeah, crazy.
Almost like you've missed the boat, you've missed your window. Sorry, move on.
Then in September of that year, they released Waiting for the Weekend, another single from the album. Now, that didn't even chart at all. Now, it's like the impact of that strike had stopped the kind of ball rolling with them, you know, basically just stopped them in their tracks, and they literally started not getting the chart success after that. Really disappointing, sad.
Right.
So that's 1980. 81, they released Spiders, the single Spiders.
Spiders inside her head. She's in danger, she's easily led. She's on missions from morning till night. She takes pictures with infrared light. Secret agent, Miss CP19. I still love you, Miss CP19. But every morning when she jumps out of bed, she shakes the spiders playing inside her head. She's got spiders inside her head. She can't control her baby spiders. She wants them dead.
Another great song, but again, didn't chart. But then in February, they recorded a Radio 1 in concert session at the Paris Theatre. In March, they released the second album, Magnets. That, again, didn't make any impact. But it's a great album, as you know.
Underrated, I would say that.
Yeah,
it's got some very good tracks on it.
Yeah.
Even, you know, and we're fans, but They are very good.
Then in July, they released another single, a great, really catchy single called Jimmy Jones. About a reference to a cult leader called Jim Jones, and that did make a Top of the Pops appearance for that, so it was their third Top of the Pops they did manage to make, but nevertheless it still only got in at number 44 in the UK chart, so very surprising really.
What did you think of the difference between the two albums, because they were different, weren't they, between Days and Magnet? I mean, that's a good thing, it's all about the creative process and variety and so on, but it was quite a different sound, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't know how you'd best describe it.
There was different production on the two albums, I thought.
So
whether that was just the difference.
I'd go with that.
I mean, there's the songs I thought were as strong as they were on the first album.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it was just this really different. If you take, you know, your News at 10 or Turning Japanese or your, you know, Waiting for the Weekend, they've got a particular sound,
yes,
you know, associated to them, whereas Magnets had a very different sound. As I say, maybe it was just about production. I don't know, but
I don't know how to even pigeonhole it, but you're right. It does have a different kind of vibe to it, and production could well be the explanation for that. Now, interestingly enough, the band had a seventh single lined up for release called Red Flag. And it was set for release, but the record company pulled the plug on it, effectively ending the relationship with the band, who then split up shortly afterwards. So it kind of like a very sort of sad end to it.
Okay, so what happened after they split in 81. What happened then?
Dave became a solicitor specializing in music law, and he worked as an in-house solicitor for the Musicians Union. Now, Ed started to work as a producer for BBC television and continues to do so, actually, with lots of credits to his name, including Doctor Who. Steve formed a band called Shoot Dispute, which had a John Peel session, more than one John Peel session, actually, and toured supporting Bruce Foxton. And Howard ran an independent record shop in Guildford for many years. And then he worked at the Performing Rights Society. And I found an interesting little fact that in 2017, he stood as the Labour Party candidate in Guildford South East County Council elections.
Then I know there was a reunion. So what was the lead up to that then? What happened?
Yeah, so Steve's band was playing in one of the classic gig venues in London called the Half Moon in Putney. Partway through his set, Dave and Ed walked up onto the stage and joined him and played Turning Japanese. It started rumours were rife, basically, that the Vapors were coming back again, like a little taster, really. And then in October, they officially reformed with a gig in Dublin. And they had a new drummer called Michael Bowles. He took over from Howard. And in October, they played, in October 17, they played at the 229 Club in London, where, of course, we saw them together.
We did. That was one of those things that we said to each other, if the Vapors ever get back together,
yeah,
no matter where we are in the world, we're going.
Yeah. Ed sometimes had commitments for TV producing. So, for example, in 2018, they played 3 dates in New York City and Ed had other commitments. So Dave's son, Dan Fenton, played guitar for the band. Then they released together the album. So that's one of the longest in history. It's one of the longest gaps between albums of any band, 39 years. And it included the second single, which is a great single, Together. Together.
We've been through troubled times, we've been through stormy waters. It took its toll on us, raising our sons and daughters. Now in the Arizona, we got our stuff together. We're even closer now, we can be close forever. I used to think about you sometimes, instead of thinking about me. We used to laugh, but we don't sometimes. That's what we both need.
They released some other singles from it, Girl from the Factory and Wonderland. And then in 21, they went out on Nuclear Day's 40th anniversary tour. And that year and the year after, they released a couple of download singles, When My Dreams Came True and Novocaine. In 22, talking about From the Jam then did the Sound Effects 40th anniversary. So I found Sound Effects was a Jam album. And obviously the From the Jam toured it as their version of it. And The Vapor supported them again on that tour. So
that relationship with Bruce then still sounds like it's really strong.
Absolutely. Just a couple more little facts. I mean, they played loads of gigs. I'm just mentioning a few examples here. But in 23, they played in Guildford. And that was for Dave's 70th. They played in Guildford. But they also played in the States at the Cruel World Festival in Pasadena, California. And this year, they've played at Port Marion already. And it's been an annual gig for them since 2017. Now, if anybody hasn't been to Port Marion, it's the most magical place. Honestly, it's great, great place to visit, really. Honestly,
they did like a convention there, I think, didn't they? Like the Vapors Convention.
And then they have like, but it's like just a great place, really interesting place. Right now, they've got another US tour scheduled and they have released the single Eyes on the Prize. So that's the Vapors.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Let's go now to speak to Dave and Steve. Welcome, Dave and Steve, to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Dave, just tell us a little bit about your initial inspiration. What sort of things were you listening to when you were younger?
Ooh, it goes back a long way. It ended up being bands like Devo. Well, I started off with the Beatles. The Beatles were the first band I ever saw. My parents took me at the age of 10. I went with my younger brother, who was eight. So that's one of my first memories. Either that or go to a fun fair in Bournemouth. But so the Beatles were playing in Bournemouth, so we went there instead. So, yeah, Stones, Small Faces, the mod bands of the 60s, developing out into, U2, Devo, that's a lot. Yeah, I actually got to see them a couple of times, which is good.
Oh, brilliant. And did Devo wear their flower pot hats?
Yes.
Oh, did they?
I remember them standing back against their guitar amps and so on. It was lit from behind. It was a really impressive stage show without too much exercise going on. It's very, very, it inspired me considerably in terms of how to present yourself.
Fantastic. So Dave, where did the name The Vapors come from? How did you come up with the name?
It came out of the dictionary. Just thumbing through. I wanted a name that wasn't physical. You couldn't, it's not tangible. You couldn't touch it. So something smoky, something, and vapors came up as a possibility. And I don't know. I've lived with that for a while now, obviously, and I think we could have done better, but it's served its purpose.
That's great. It's a good
And
name.
it was without the U right from day one.
Yes. Yeah,
We
I was going to ask
always
you about that.
went for an American spelling.
Yeah.
And because it's smaller, you can get bigger letters in the same space. Doesn't look so ugly as sticking a U in it. It's not unnecessary.
I mean, I saw it. The BBC credited your Peel session with a U, but I guess a few people make mistakes over the years anyway with a
You
U.
still do. Some promoters even now still spell it with a U. We have to tell them off again.
Yeah, tell them off.
You think 40, after 45 years, I would have got used to
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't
it, but
you?
we would.
So that journey then, when you first started, yourself, Ed, Howard, and Steve, just talk us through that journey in sort of maybe 78-ish.
But there was a kind of Mark One version of the band, which Dave started in 1978
Yeah.
with three other people. And that was the first Vapors that I saw, and I thought they were great. But it was really just a local band playing sort of locally around. And because of that, that band kind of fell apart.
And yeah, Ed and Howard were in a band called Ellery Bops, and Steve was in a band called The Absolute, and they all split up about the same time. And I went around picking the best musicians from each of those defunct bands to add to and bring into the Vapors.
So your original lineup before those guys joined, I think they went to university, didn't they?
Yeah, that was the problem, really. That's why all these bands were splitting up at the same time. They were all 18, leaving school, going to university, or their parents wanted them to go to the university of their choice.
Yeah.
So me trying to get them to stay at home and be in a band didn't go down too well with the various families. But
And that kind of all happened about, was that February, March 1979?
yeah.
The first gig the four of us did as that lineup was, it was early in April, I think, or March or April 1979. And that's when the four of us came together. And then I think it was like a second or third gig on a Sunday night in a venue called the Scratchers, the Three Lions in Farncombe near Guildford. And not very many people in the pub, but one of them was Bruce Foxton of The Jam, who hung around after we finished playing, said how much he liked it. I said, look, if I can try and swing it, would you like to come and play on a couple of gigs on the Jam tour that's just coming up in May? Which we all thought, well, yes.
Of course.
We'd really like that. I was thinking, for one thing, I'm getting in free to see the Jam. That's great. And we went down well in the two gigs that we did with the Jam, and that got Bruce more and more interested, and he became more and more helping us out more and more, and brought John Weller along to a Guildford gig, which was it was a really good night. And afterwards, John said, "Yeah, me and Bruce together would like to manage you guys. And what do you think?" There wasn't exactly a big queue of people wanting to manage us, so the fact that these two amazing people wanted to do it, it was brilliant. We just said, yeah, we'll go for that totally. And then through John and his connections, we started getting gigs. John was going having meetings with record companies, and things started, that's when things started coming together, really. But it was very early on in the four of us playing together that started happening. It was within like 2 months.
Incredible. So we previously spoke to a few bass players on these podcasts. We spoke to Lee Hirons of the Faith Brothers, Steve Hovington of B Movie, and Dave Sparrow of the Photos. Did you start playing the bass as your first instrument? What your how your journey to the bass was?
I started off playing piano when I was about, I'd say, quite young, six, 7 years old. My mother made me go for piano lessons every week and play the piano every day. And so I did that for maybe, I got up to grade five, I think. So I did it for
Wow.
4 or 5 years or something. But then I really wanted a guitar because I wanted to be a guitar player. So I eventually managed to persuade my parents to buy me a guitar. And for a few years, I was a guitar player. Then in the mid-70s, my cousins who had a covers band playing in working men's clubs up north, they came to see me at my work and said, look, we need a bass player. We think you can do it. How much are you earning here? I told them how much I was earning working in a Debenhams store. And I said, well, we'll pay you more than that. So that was a really easy choice. And that's really how I became a bass player, because my cousin's band needed a bass player, decided it was me, bought me a bass, bought me an amp, and started gigging every week with them.
So, Dave, did you start on guitar yourself?
Yeah. I mean, apart from junior school, learning the recorder,
Oh, who didn't?
And like Steve, I was made to have good piano lessons from the age of about five, but unlike Steve, I didn't have to do exams, so I got the experience without the stress. So yeah,
Excellent.
gave me a bit of a grounding in music and learning to read music and so on.
That's really good. So when did you get your first guitar?
The age of 10, my 10th birthday. It was second hand, but I loved it. And I taught myself to play and write songs. I mean, I couldn't play other people's songs very easily, so I wrote my own.
Oh, I love that. And you got, when did you get your first electric guitar?
That was when I was living in Redhill with my parents and working in Guildford, doing law at our school clerk. And when I came to sell my car eventually, because I needed a car for that trip, then I moved to Guildford and rented a flat and didn't need the car anymore. Then I sold it and bought my first guitar and amplifier.
Wow, fantastic.
So I would have been
That's
about 21.
wow.
Well, that Mark One version of the band then, when Bruce and John spoke to you, what songs were in the set list? What were you doing? Original songs? Was it covers?
Yeah,
What?
it was pretty much the first album, pretty much the Nuclear Days album, with a couple of others that didn't quite make it there. When the four of us got together, there was some of the first album was in the set at that time, but a lot of it wasn't. And Dave just went through, when we four of us got together, just went through this inspired period of writing where he was coming in every week with a new song, and it was another great song. Real golden patch of a few months when we just got the first set properly nailed.
Awesome. You know, we Martin and I love Nuclear Days. We both play it all the time still. Yeah, it's for us, it's as fresh now as it was.
Oh, cheers. That's really nice to hear.
I mean, I'm not surprised that Bruce and John wanted to get involved, because they are it's a very strong set.
Yeah, and I think we were really quite young as well at the time. I mean, Ed and Howard were 18, and I think I was 21. So we were quite a young band. But listening back to there's a set from The Rainbow in 1979. I listen back to it and I think we were really tight. Even at that young age, we were really good.
It's funny because when we spoke to Chris Pope from the Chords, they had a very quick rise. Literally Paul Weller in the audience invited them to go on the jam tour. They had this rapid rise for them as the Chords, very quickly, and they were in a very similar age.
They were very much around at the same time. We're good friends with them, still are.
Yeah, well, Noel and I both came to see you guys at the 229 Club, and
Oh, yeah.
obviously Chris did the support
Yeah.
for that gig. So, and Noel actually, to be fair, as saw you back in the day.
Yeah, I did see you at the Rainbow. I think I did two nights at the Rainbow, and I did the whole of that tour about four times, different gigs. I remember, I don't know if it's the Rainbow gigs, but John Weller was, we used to come on occasionally and introduce the Jam, like, "Well, we're
No,
the best rock and roll band in the world."
he did not occasionally. He did every
Every,
gig.
yeah. And it was amazing, and that power and that energy, it must have been such a great influence on you as a manager.
Yeah, John was great. He was really straight all the time. There's no bullshit with John. He just gave it to you straight. And I admired him for that. God bless him. God rest his soul.
Yes.
So you then got Appeal Session, and talk to us a little bit about that, because that's another common theme that we've seen with some of the bands that we've spoken to.
Did you send the tape in, Dave?
Yeah, I did.
Dave just sent a tape in to radio to John Waters,
Yeah.
presumably. To John Waters, the producer, and he just that was completely independent of, although Bruce and John were kind of around at that point, this was kind of independent of them, which was quite gratifying. And it was recorded on a very basic 8-track, in a very basic 8-track studio at that time. The BBC was not state of the art, but I really liked that demo, that session, I mean.
That's great, because normally when we've spoken to bands who've done Peel sessions, they've gone into Maida Vale and had all these high production stuff on
Oh,
it.
yeah,
So
it
that's great,
changed.
yeah.
It did change. I think I ended up doing some Peel sessions with a band I was in afterwards. And when I went back to the same studio, it was all of a sudden, it was like the Starship Enterprise in there. The difference was incredible. In like 3 years, it had gone from being really, really antiquated to state of the art.
It must have been such an amazing moment for you to have got to have had that.
I remember the night where the record company, we had two record companies interested in us, Polydor, who the Jam were with, and United Artists. We chose United Artists because we didn't really have too many connections with the Jam. I mean, management was one anyway, but having the record label as
Yes.
well, we do end up being dealt with as a package, two bands, and that was best not.
We had two choices, like Dave says. The only thing that stopped us going of ruling Polydor out was it would be too much, to be on the same label, and everything would have been too integrated with the Jam and the Vapors. We wanted to keep our identity separate. But the bad thing that happened was we signed to the label that where everyone really liked us in the building. There was a small amount of staff. And they kept with their acts. You could do an album. If it didn't do well, you'd still get to make another album. But within 4 or 5 months of us signing that deal, EMI had bought out United Artists
Oh.
and made all of the staff at United Artists redundant. And then we'd gone from everyone knowing us and being into the band to nobody knowing us and just by nobody knowing. First time we went to EMI, it was. Didn't know who we were, did they?
No.
Wow, that's incredible.
A lot of things came together at the same time. Obviously, at the same, it was like losing your record company when they got bought out by somebody else.
So, was turning Japanese, going so stratospheric so early, a blessing or a curse?
There's nothing else to do. Oh, it's in color. Your hair is brown. Your eyes are hazel. And soft as clouds. I often kiss you when there's no one else around. I've got your picture. I've got your picture. I'm turning down, I'm turning in, I'm turning right, I'm turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so.
It goes both ways, really. I mean, some ways we missed out on other things because we didn't have a slow rise into the public awareness. It was like a meteoric rise. Getting success too early or too soon or too easily puts people off.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
So I think we've got a bit of that. So I think there was a bit of a, they wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't for the Jam, which is perfectly true. On the second, otherwise it's, better to be a one-hit wonder than a no-hit wonder.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah,
I
it goes both ways.
can only dream.
mean, we did really sort of take this into consideration when we were talking about doing our first single. Turning Japanese came up. Obviously, it did. We were like, "Oh no, I don't think we should do that as our first single because, then we might just be a one-hit wonder." So we put out another record instead, Prisoners.
Yeah, good song, good song.
So Turning Japanese wasn't our first single, but it still went, yeah, but you can't complain about it going stratospheric, really. It was just
No.
like this mad dream happening at the time, where we'd gone from playing in little pubs to being on top of the pubs in a very short amount of time.
So did you know that the song was, it was going to be a hit?
We knew it was a great song and we knew it was a great record, but it doesn't guarantee you anything, does
no.
it? There's no. Those are great songs and great records that never got anywhere. So we were hopeful and obviously thrilled when it took off.
And what was the Top of the Pops experience like?
Weird, bizarre experience. Yeah, plastic cymbals on the drum kit, you know, people being shoved around, giant cameras in your face. I'd grown up with that program and so Dave, and you know, we religiously watched it every week, and it's always, what do you want to do when you go up? Oh, I want to be on Top of the Pops. And there we were on it, and that was, for me, it was kind of, wow, I've actually done that now.
Bearing in mind today, you can't really comprehend the impact that being on that program had on the bands and the record sales, can you?
It's 15 million viewers. I mean, nothing gets that kind of viewing figures these days. It's incredible. And it was very, very influential in terms of selling records.
When United Artists then got taken over by EMI, what effect did that have on the band?
It was totally depressing.
Yeah.
Obviously, because initially everyone in the record company knew us, like what we were doing. And you know, we've been signed to like a family firm. So United Artists effectively became EMI, looking after EMI artists, and we weren't.
And you lost John and Bruce as well in terms of management. Yeah,
the following year, they came to us and said, sorry, you guys, Jam's just taking up too much time now. You know, when we got the offer of management, the Jam hadn't had any number one singles. And suddenly, got a string of number one singles, and they're too busy. The other side of it was that we were doing quite well in America. We were over there a lot, or the Jam were in Europe. So we hardly ever got to see Bruce or John.
Right, yeah.
So we accepted that, you know, when they say, sorry, chaps, we can't do this. We thought we could, but we can't. You just have to say, you have to agree with them, because you can't argue with that, really, can you?
No.
Yes, lost the record company, lost their management. And then the third thing that hit us was the follow-up to Turn to Japanese, News at 10, was put out, and nobody knew it was put out. You know, the United Artists, run by EMI, had no idea we were releasing a single.
We're riding high in the charts and everything's going really great, except our record company's gone, our management's gone, and the next single, Top the Pops, is on strike and you're not on. And that, you know, that was because again, we knew it was a great song and it was a great record, but this one didn't happen.
Yeah,
but
we've had a similar thing with other podcasts we've done, actually. Quite a few other bands have had exactly the same experience. Mega songs, and then the same thing with the record company and the Top of the Pops strikes and other things have just frustrated the whole process. So
yeah, but people still really love that song, so
oh god, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It doesn't really matter that it didn't go in the charts.
If we talk about post the single, then you obviously then, you know, you've managed to get tours in globally, really, USA, Australia and other areas. How did the audiences differ, for example, between the UK and those areas?
And there were more people at the gigs in America, I would say. That's one of the big differences. We actually did better in America than we did in the UK in a lot of ways. That was the main difference, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You did some TV appearances in America as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. I think Solid Gold, I think we did, with Dionne Warwick was the host.
All right.
And they had like a dancing troupe, like Pan's People kind of dancing going on. So that was quite funny.
You've been back to America, haven't you, recently?
Yeah, we've been three times back to America.
Yeah.
We did a weekend trip where we played three nights at the Mercury Lounge in New York. I think 2018 we did that around late in the year. 2019 we did the Lost 80s package tour with a lot of other bands from the 80s where we only had to play for 20 minutes, play four songs. But that was brilliant because a lot of people at those gigs and they all, when we played Turning Japanese, they went nuts, went absolutely nuts. And then last year we did the Cruel World Festival, which is a massive, huge festival where we played to 35,000 people.
Wow.
But that was just for one off. And this summer we're going to California to do six of the 80s package tour shows. And then we're going to do four on the East Coast, do two at the Mercury Lounge in New York, one in Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, and one in Woodstock. So, yes, six 80s shows, four of our own shows. And really looking forward to that, really, because we know the sun will be shining.
Yeah.
And after the after those dates, we're going to go into the studio with a friend of ours producing, and we're going to do album number four.
Oh, awesome. That's great news.
Well, I'm glad that it's not taking another 30 years between the albums.
Exactly. We've got always, like, if anyone says it's a bit of a long time, you're going to be kidding. it is about time. It's 4 years now since.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've got 20 songs.
We've got some of them finished already, and some of them are rearing to go.
Well, if they're all as strong as Eyes on the Prize, then we're in for a treat, I think.
Yes.
I hope so. I was wondering about that. I can't tell anymore. People say it doesn't sound like The Vapors, or it does sound like The Vapors. I don't think The Vapors are going to sound. You know? I just write what we write.
I'm really excited about it. I think we've got some great songs.
Okay, let's look at the you've got Nuclear Days, you've got Turning Japanese, massive success. You then go into Magnets. Talk to us about that, that journey from Nuclear Days to Magnets.
Compressed into quite a short time span, really, because we were out touring Turning Japanese and the first album for months, if not years. And so when the record company said, well, let's have a follow-up album, there wasn't a follow-up album just sitting there. It was like half written and the old idea for a song with nothing finished. So it was frantic writing sessions going on. And I had no idea what to expect to come out. I had no idea what was The Vapors. People say it sounds like The Vapors. I don't know. I can't see a distinctive sound, really. Definitely with Magnets, we went through a rockier sound, guitar-wise, heavier guitars rather than a clearer, cleaner.
The production on Magnet seems to, you're right, the guitar's sort of perhaps more in the front, but how did you look back now with that at that with a still with affection?
Yeah, I mean, we went for that sort of sound with Dave Tickle. We went for a rockier sound with Dave Tickle, and we got it, so I can't complain.
It was the way that it was produced and recorded and mixed, which made it sound different to Nuclear Days, really. I don't think it was necessarily much that we were doing, but just the way that it was captured. It's mainly we left it to the producer, yeah, didn't we, to produce, and we were just like, we'll do whatever you want us to do. We'll play what we play and sing what we sing. But we were very much, you know, new to the industry at that level. And, you know, we were working with Vic Smith, who'd done all the jam stuff. And then with Dave Tickle, who'd done Split Ends and, you know, other great stuff. And we tended to, once you've got a producer in, you have to trust them. And we did.
The thing is, you know, Vic Coppersmith Heaven's always done fantastic stuff for the Jam. So, you know, the same. It's a great album. I've some great songs there. I really like Civic Hall, by the way. It's one of my favourites.
A true story, that song.
Is it? Is what, some a jam jar in a plastic bag?
Yes, Dave getting harassed by the police. That's what that one's about. By the Civic Hall.
There you go.
The whole song is about police harassment. I mean, I really like the production on Magnets. I think it's really, some of it's really great. But that's the main, it wasn't us that changed. It was more the producer that was changed and changed the sound.
I suppose the only thing would be that, obviously, it didn't get the success you might have hoped for, I guess. And would that be down to EMI, down to the record company, not giving it enough of a push?
Yeah, I mean, we were still stuck with them.
I guess that they were more interested in their big artists than
the totally. I mean, Duran was a lot more important than us.
We become a very small fish in a very big pond.
Yeah, that's crazy, though, isn't it? They've spent the money to get an album put out. They're not bothered promoting it almost, And the same with not even knowing that News at 10 was coming out. I mean, that's pretty outrageous. Yeah,
that was the head of A&R, Dave Ambrose. Wanted to see him. He had to go out of the office and check out whether we had a release. He said, yes, it has been released. I can't believe, you know, that I'm saying for your record company not to want to record you is, yeah, it's very depressing.
Oh, God, yeah.
Where'd you go? You're tied up exclusively to them.
I understand that you'd recorded Red Flag as a single to be released, and the record label pulled it.
We didn't get as far as the studio. The A&R man came to rehearsal, played it through to him. He recorded it on a cassette, and then we were supposed to be going in the studio over that weekend, and he pulled the studio time on the Friday night. But he just pulled the studio time, and it was just like, oh, we can't work with people like this. What's the point? You know, we'd gone through all these kind of crises, but this was just like the final straw in a way. Dave and Dan did an acoustic version.
Thank you.
I have to say, it's a cracking song, and it's like a real earworm. It's one of those songs that you keep singing, repeating back to yourself.
Yeah.
Is it something that you would do anything with now, or have you decided to consign it to history?
Too many bad memories, really. I think we, you know, just doing an acoustic version of it in the first place was just simply to stop people.
Oh, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
It's still great. It's a great.
Go and listen to that.
Can I apologise for bringing it up?
You can. It's your job.
It was kind of the song that broke us up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to ask actually about after that. Was that the sort of start of that sort of that final split?
Yeah,
the start and end of it. That was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, the last straw was put in the recording time. Where'd you go from there?
But yeah, that was it. Really, the last straw. That yeah, the next day we were finished. Really.
Wow. I mean, that seems so final.
It was for a long time.
How can you get on with a record company that won't record you? No management.
Because these days it would be very different, wouldn't it? Because you can record stuff, different technology, and it's very available.
Yeah, it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper to record stuff, you know, really high quality material yourselves. You can just do it yourselves, buy a computer program for 80, 90 quid, and you can do, you know, top quality recordings. If you know what you're doing. Back then, you would be paying a fortune per day to go into the studio. But that was the only way you could really make records then.
So that sort of, today I'm in a band, tomorrow I'm not in a band. And were you still writing all the way through that? Or had you stopped?
For the first 10 years after I left the band, I had another band with my wife and her brother and various other people, which did quite well. I mean, we did that for about 10 years, didn't we? Doing local gigs, London gigs. It wasn't until we decided to have kids that I thought, well, I can't be a sound engineer while I've got a family. Because it just meant being away from home more to earn more money. So we decided to go back to my legal profession. I was already qualified as a solicitor. I did that in 1977. April Fool's Day, 1977, I became a lawyer. Says everything, doesn't it?
Steve, what about your title? Because obviously you went in, was it Shoot Dispute, I think?
I did that for a while. We did a couple of John Peel sessions. We went on tour with Bruce Foxton. We got close, but we didn't quite get there. And after that, I was in other bands as well, but I started doing sound engineering. And I did that touring Europe a lot. Went to America a couple of times doing that. For bizarrely, I got a name for doing sound for noise bands back in the day in the late 80s. I started doing a band called World Domination Enterprises, who were like really good friends of mine. And then all of a sudden, all these other noise bands like Loop, Lush, they're all phoning me up saying, come and do our sound. So I did that for quite a while because that was quite good fun. And I liked being able to make it sound like I wanted it to sound like.
So fast forward then. So Noel and I, when you split, you know, we were disappointed, obviously, as you guys were. We said to each other, we made this pact that whatever happens, if the Vapors ever get back together again, we will go together and see them. That period, that 34 years, what happened? How did you get to this stage where suddenly it was, you know, we were back on the road, we got together, the album, you know, talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I was working at the Greyhound in Fulham, Dave came in with Brankford with their band and I did the sound for them.
So it wasn't that we'd fallen out between ourselves?
But initially it was, we initially were just offered four gigs. Howard had just had two young children, so he was very involved in parenting his children. He just really didn't have time for it. But me, Ed and Dave, we said, yeah, why not? Why not just do four gigs? And will anyone come to them? Will anyone remember who we are? But we got such a good reaction from the four gigs that we thought, well, let's just maybe just keep going. But it was very, you know, we only did four gigs in 2016. I think we probably only did like six or seven in the next year. It was only in the last, it was mainly sort of 2018, 19, 20. That's when we really started working hard again and getting quite a lot of gigs. But then, of course, COVID came along and ruined all of that.
It was almost like something was conspiring against you, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you then made Together, which is once again great stuff. And was that in a similar vein to Magnets, where you'd had a short period post the reunion, obviously not leading up to the reunion, but to write the songs, or had you just been cataloguing those and had a little library of them?
Well, obviously, we reformed in 2016, so yeah, there was three or four years we've been accumulating songs, and then we had to sort of shake them out and see which ones stuck, which ones were well, with the band. It's funny sometimes, the band playing something I've written, we just fall into place naturally, and other times we have real trouble getting them,
So it's
and that's
quite democratic then, so everybody kind of gets
yeah.
has to be happy with the vibe for each track, yeah.
I tend to leave the middle eight out now, and they can work on that.
And what comes first, Dave? Is it the lyrics? Is it the melody? What's the
Sometimes it's all of them at the same time. Sometimes I wake up in the morning with a tune in my head. My
That's
phone
great.
is full of it's got about, I've been through it recently to filter out, like I said, songs that I don't want, but I use my phone to record tunes and lyrics and so on. Just something over 1,000 on my phone.
1,000 songs on your phone.
1,000 tunes. I've got plenty of choice.
So how did you find Michael, the man with the winning smile, your new drummer?
He came down and played at a rehearsal. It was quite strange because one of the bands that I'm still in at the time were going through drummers like there was no tomorrow. They were really hard to find a good drummer. And when Howard couldn't do it, I was going, oh my God, who are we going to get to play the drums? It's really difficult finding a good drummer these days. But Dave said, well, I know this guy Michael that I was in a band with before. And yeah, A, he was into doing it, and B, he turned up and he'd learned the songs and played
Wow.
really great. And so it became an incredibly easy thing to find a drummer.
Oh, that's great. Dan's influences include AC/DC and Queens of the Stone Age and so on, but he plays very similar to Ed's style. He's a real asset to the band, isn't he?
Well, he is, and to fall in on Ed's style is brilliant. I mean, obviously, he's still playing the same solos that Ed wrote in the early stuff, the first two albums. But obviously, it influenced him on what he put on together.
So, how did Dan get into the Vapors? I guess growing up, he was listening to it.
He found my albums in our music collection and played them, learnt them. He learned to, learnt to play them.
He found the, when he was a kid and started playing guitar, he found Nuclear Days in his in the family record cabinet, and he learned. He said he's really influenced by that album's guitar playing because, and that's why. I mean, I think in a lot of ways he's very similar to Ed in that he's very creative, and the stuff he comes up with is great. But I don't think it's necessarily got much of a AC/DC influence on it.
No.
Very lucky to find Dan as well. When we needed a guitar player, he was just there, and he knew all the songs.
I tried to get him interested in playing guitar when he was about 8 or 9, or in a small scale acoustic, but he just didn't touch it. The next thing I know, he's got an electric guitar, amps, and got more than one electric guitar. He's really, from the age of about 15 or 16, he's really gone into it. And
That's
learned
cool.
everything we needed him to learn when we needed a guitarist. We have fallen on our feet there, I think. Same as we did with Michael, the drummer.
It was again, that was incredibly
Yeah.
easy, wasn't it? It's not all crises, we've had a few lucky breaks as well, especially when we were starting back in the day, from when we started to when we got to Top of the Pops, we had a lot of good fortune. It was just as soon as we got to Top of the Pops, it went bad then. But yeah, we were lucky to find Michael, lucky that Dan was a great guitar player, and lucky that we're still rolling.
We're both friends with the photographer Derek D'Souza
Oh
from
yeah.
different bands that we used to go and see, The Truth for Martin and the Faith Brothers for me. And he seems to have done a lot of live shots of your gigs.
Yeah, we bumped into him years ago, quite early on, and he asked us if we'd mind, taking photos, so we give him carte blanche any gigs. So.
Good stuff. Good guy to know.
Yeah.
One of my biggest regrets, now I live in Spain now, as you know, is that I never got to go to your regular Port Merion annual kind of gigs. I mean, that sounds like an amazing thing.
Yeah, I think we've done five now. And quite a lot of people have been to three, quite a few people, some people have been to five of them because it's an amazingly strange place. It's always a good time. Everyone comes and has, like, we did it this year. We let the people in the audience get up and sing Vapors songs with us, the band. And you had to book a slot. But the night before we did our gig, we had fans getting up and singing with us. Which I think they really enjoyed, the audience really enjoyed, and it was really good fun for us as well. But we try and make Port Merion a bit special. We don't just play our normal set. One of the first Port Merions, we played the whole of Nuclear Days in one set, and then another set of everything else. So yeah, it's a special place, and we try and make it a special weekend. because we do it over two nights now.
We ask this question to everybody that has been on the podcast, which is talk to us a little bit about your greatest memory.
Being awarded a gold disc in Sydney Harbour. It was nice. Wow. It was a lovely day out. In fact, it was gold and platinum on the one go. It was quite good.
So I guess that was turning Japanese. It went to number one in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only number three here.
Yes, only.
No, we managed top 40 in America, but that was spread out. I mean, it got released on import in New York, and it gradually went around the country east to west, charting in every state gradually. So it took about 6 months or 8 months to travel around and sell itself out. So it never really got very high in the charts. It sold loads of records.
Yeah, it was kind of consistent, just consistently kept going.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, it was very recently, in fact, a year ago, when we walked on stage at Cruel World Festival, and there were 35,000 people out there, and they loved it. And for me, that was the best, absolute best. Apart from that, seeing myself on Top of the Pops, that would be my other memory.
Okay, brilliant. No thanks, problem. Dave and Steve. We really appreciate it. You've got a fantastic legacy, and we absolutely love you guys. So, but thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Much appreciated.
Yeah, cheers.
See you soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, then you can, of course, contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, the Uncharted 80s. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.